Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. With tensions running high between the West and the Islamic world, particularly the Arab Islamic world, it is more important than ever that we try to understand the role that religion and political culture play in everyday Muslim society. And that is something that we will try to explore here in this first hour of Focus 580 as we talk with anthropologist Lawrence Rosen. He says that there are many aspects of Muslim life that are puzzling to Westerners, and he suggests perhaps that a common thread that runs through all of them, something that maybe will help us understand better, is the importance that Arabs place on interpersonal relationships. He is here visiting the campus to give a talk. This is a program in the MillerCom series. He'll be talking on the topic, Protecting the Prophet, Understanding Muslim Reactions to the Danish Cartoon Controversy. I'm sure people will remember this series of events of a couple of years ago. He'll be talking this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. This is on West Illinois in Urbana. And these events, they're always free and open to the public. So anybody who is listening is certainly welcome to attend. Also, I want to mention that this particular, these ideas that he talks about in, he will talk about this afternoon, are just some of what you will find in a book that is scheduled for publication this summer, I believe, by the University of Chicago Press, the title Varieties of Muslim Experience, Encounters with Arab Political and Cultural Life. So that is something that you can look forward to this summer. And here, of course, on the program, we welcome questions and comments from listeners. The only thing we ask is that people try to keep their comments brief so we can keep moving on. But callers are certainly welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm very pleased to be back to Urbana, where I started my career, as a matter of fact.
Well, glad to have you here. The very big question that I hope we can talk about is the disconnect between the Muslim world, particularly the Arab Muslim world, and the West, meaning essentially Europe and the United States. And here, though, I think you put it across some very interesting ideas and something that perhaps will be new to people as they think about this and may indeed have to do with the fact that you are an anthropologist. And much of the commentary on this issue perhaps comes from historians or political scientists. And it has to do with this business of relationships, social relationships, and how people think about the notion of the self and the differences between those things in the Arab-Muslim world and in the West.
You know, there are times I think that, while from the point of view of many people in this country, there seems to be a disconnect. In fact, it's really only rather slight difference. Of course, if you're 5 degrees off and you go far enough, you can wind up in very different places. But I think that one of the things that people in this country at least need to appreciate is that there is a very great deal that is very familiar about the way in which Arab social life is organized. I guess I would ask people to think of it a little bit this way. If you have even the most touristic sort of image of the Arab world, think of the marketplace, where hawking and haggling are rampant, where prices are not fixed, where the quantity and quality of things may be up to you to figure out. How do you operate in that kind of situation? The only places we do that really are with real estate and automobiles. Those are about the only things we really bargain over, and we're not sure what the quality of that used car really is. Imagine now a social world in which you're constantly negotiating with people, not manipulating, not finagling in a nasty way, but you have the freedom, even within your kin group and beyond that kin group, to forge alliances and ties with other people. The Arabs often say that in debt there is relationship. You have to have bonds of indebtedness to people. It's sort of like an electrical system. It's got to have pluses and minuses to hold together. If you pull the plug and it's all pluses or all minuses, nothing holds together anymore. So to be a mature and knowledgeable person is to be someone who negotiates in the world, who forges alliances, dependencies, relationships in very regularized ways. There are distinctive ways you have to do it. And then the anthropological conceit is that everything's connected to everything. The economists may factor out only the economic, and the politicians, the political science aspect of things. Anthropologists see that religion relates to kinship, and kinship relates to politics, and politics relates to ecology, and everything's connected. So when I think of that kind of marketplace of negotiated relationships, a kind of web of indebtedness, a bond of obligations that people must form with one another, I think of the ways in which it's reflected in, connected to religion, to politics, to all sorts of domains. But just that image of the marketplace, negotiating one's way through it, may be a good starting point for people in this country to imagine how you can have an entire social system that's built along, at least metaphorically, those sort of lines.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in this notion that we can get into trouble because in the West we seem to have this willingness or this ability to split ourselves, in a sense, into different selves and to draw distinctions between me and how I am at home with my family, how I am at work, how I am in the public sphere and the private sphere. That's one of the things maybe that helps us to say, well, we believe in separation between church and state, and politics and religion should be separate. And that it seems that within Arab society, that kind, drawing those kinds of lines and distinctions is just not something that people do.
I guess one of the ways I would put it is the conception of a person is of a complete unity, and indeed one ought not to have what we may regard as inconsistent elements about your social and personal position in things. Let me give you an example. I often tell people about a couple of cases from the United States Supreme Court involving the death penalty. In the one case, Justice Frankfurter says, I'm really opposed to the death penalty, but as a justice of the United States Supreme Court, I must uphold it. And Justice Blackmun, in a really poignant opinion, at one point says, I am completely opposed to the death penalty. But I cannot enforce my own view, I'm reading from his opinion, rather than the consensus of society's opinion. And he goes on and he says, if I were a legislator, I would vote against it. If I were an ordinary citizen, I would march in the streets against it. But as a Supreme Court justice, I must impose this death penalty. Now, when I mention this to people in North Africa and Egypt and places where I've worked, they start to ask me a series of questions usually. Who is this man? Where is he from? Who is he related to? Has he or anybody close to him ever been the victim of a crime? And what they seem to be saying to me is, if I only knew enough about this person, I would know that this is not inconsistent for him. For us, it's kind of commonsensical that I can play different roles, and those may be inconsistent even to the point of imposing the death penalty when I'm personally opposed to it, because as a judge I must. To most of the people I speak with in the Arab world, the idea of a fractionated self is almost incomprehensible. Rather, you exist in relationships with other people in a variety of contexts and situations, and to know another person is to know the consistency that holds them together as a person, not how they may act contrary to different aspects of themselves. Maybe another example would help. I have a series of pictures that I sometimes show people. It's of an individual they do not know, taken at different times in the person's life. And you spread them out on the table and you say, tell me about this guy. I strongly suspect that you and most of our listeners looking over my shoulder would start putting that story together chronologically. Oh, there he was when he was a little kid. My goodness, did they wear that style and back in those days? And right on through, because for us, time reveals the truth of persons. Look at our sacred texts, in the beginning, in the middle, at the end. Look how we tell a story, once upon a time. And we unfold the story chronologically to tell the truth of persons. But that's not what these folks will usually do. Oh, chronology is important to them, and if it's a particularly chronological issue, they'll certainly speak to it. But instead, they'll point out and say, see, here he is with this group of people. Oh, there he is with that other group. Oh, here he is with that other group. And that may be all out of order chronologically, because people are defined by the networks of their relationships. You go into a court of law, and I've worked a lot in the Muslim courts in North Africa, some in Malaysia, it gets a bit different there, and the judge, the first thing he wants to know, now sometimes she, who are you connected to? where are you in a network of relationships? That's what defines a person. And that becomes very crucial in lots of different ways, because that sense of identity as embeddedness in webs of affiliation and obligation is what holds society together. If there's a fear, it's the fear clearly expressed both culturally and in the Quran of what's called fitna. Fitna translates well as chaos, but it really means when social bonds are unclear, when the pluses and minuses are not hanging together. So politically, if the West, for example, fails to engage Muslims, particularly Arabs, in negotiation, it seems as though one is treating them as though they are not real persons. To turn your back on somebody, literally and figuratively, is to break that bond of indebtedness. Far better that you have this running imbalance than that you pull the plug. And we sometimes make the mistake of not engaging people in contact because we think we can't negotiate with them, when it is the very process of engagement that is vital to treating them with respect and then seeing where it may go.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Lawrence Rosen. He is the William Nelson Cromwell Professor of Anthropology at Princeton University. He's also adjunct professor of law at Columbia Law School. He works mostly in the Muslim world, working on Islamic law and the structure of social life. He's here visiting the campus to give a talk. This is a MillerCom event this afternoon on the campus. It's open to anybody who is interested. And, of course, here we're welcome. We're open to and would welcome callers. If you want to ask a question, make a comment, you can certainly do that. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. We do, in fact, have a caller, and let us talk with them. Someone in Champaign on our line number one. Hello.
Hi. I have three questions I'd like to ask and then listen up on air to your responses. Your talk so far has brought up a general question to me about whether Islam can be democratic in the way we understand it. And I'll let you talk about that. But let me sort of break that out into two different aspects. And the first has to do with the Prophet Muhammad and whether there can be a scholarly biography of him which isn't hagiographic and what should I say, too weighted to the religious orthodoxy, which tends to be what most of what we have. Sometimes we have people like Karen Armstrong, who writes arguing that essentially you can't judge Muhammad by contemporary ethical standards. And then at times you have more polemical works from Islamic side or from the critical side, such as The Truth About Muhammad by Robert Spencer, which is a different, very critical biography, but also very much, challenged by orthodoxy in Islam. So that's one second question. And the third question has to do with the ability of universities to seriously examine Islam in a critical way, especially given the enormous amount of funds that are coming from Islamic sources and the effect that those funds are having to the extent that, let us say, in Great Britain, there's a sense that many academics are afraid and nervous to handle topics that upset their sponsors, and that they're actually reports now even saying that some centers argue that only Muslims should be teaching Islam. And then we have the case, let's say, in the United States, where we have Saudis giving enormous $20 million plus to places like Harvard and Georgetown, and how that affects the scholarship in those areas. So I'll get off and listen to your responses. Thank you very much.
Right. Thank you.
Those are all excellent questions. Let me take them briefly one at a time. Can Islam be democratic? Obviously, what's crucial is how you're going to conceptualize democracy. But I always think of democracy as a government of limited powers. Elections may be very important, but it's limitations on powers that are crucial. Now, here, there are very distinctive forms of limitation on power, even though they may not seem to be the kinds we are used to in the West. There's a kind of leveling that goes on, an almost tribal ethos. Doesn't mean people are tribal, but a kind of tribal ethos in the Arab world in which you do not want too much power in too few hands for too long a period of time. Now, that may seem contradicted by the kinds of leaders that we look at, but notice that what you have to do. I spoke a little while ago about building up networks of affiliation. That is how, in this kind of almost tribal ethos, you demonstrate your legitimacy. You must put together these kinds of alliances for people to recognize you as a proper leader. But that means that anybody who can put one together better than you did will ipso facto be legitimate. That in itself places an odd kind of limitation on power. There is also the need to constantly service your attachments, which means you must obligate yourself to those who choose to depend on you rather than choosing to depend on somebody else. President Kennedy often said, when he was asked to do certain things, you know, now how in the world am I supposed to convince the people below me to want to be able to do that sort of thing? Well, in this kind of a system, you must constantly service your webs of indebtedness, and that ironically puts a certain kind of limitation on power. There are other forms of it as well, religious, political, economic, social, and the like. So what may seem to us an odd sort of situation, that there's tremendous power in very few hands, is actually being undercut in a lot of places, and that historically has been institutionalized in certain ways, especially by the scholars, who are really quite independent and quite capable of putting some limitations on power. Another aspect of this is your question about the academic approach, particularly in the West, to the portrayal of the Prophet and indeed the teaching of Islam and Middle Eastern studies. There are, even in Arabic, numerous scholarly biographies of the Prophet that are not merely hagiographic. There's a difference between respectful and hagiographic. Remember that for Muslims, the Prophet is a very human person. He had human failings. One thinks, for example, a little notoriously in the West, of the satanic verses, that the Prophet was seduced for a short time by including a couple of the idol gods within Islam, only to realize that this was inappropriate, backed around and changed, but this was a demonstration of his very humanity. So many biographies can be written. Think of Maxime Rodinson's biography of the Prophet. Even some of the very early writers, I think it was Hawthorne in the West, who very early on wrote a biography of Muhammad. We've got a town just up the road here called Mahomet. Somebody maybe can call in and explain that one to me. There's also a Morocco, Indiana, I believe. So I'm not quite sure how we explain some of these things. But my point is that one does not have to be hagiographic. I happen to agree with the caller. I think Karen Armstrong is too deferential. I think Spencer is much too critical. But yes, I think it is possible. And I think it's been done. The last point that you raised concerns sponsorship of academic institutions by some of the Arab notables and countries. I'm not romanticizing it, but at my own university, at the universities of Chicago and Harvard and other places where I've been, nobody who gives the money calls the tune. That's not how American universities work. The money comes with a clear understanding that appointments will not be in any way influenced by the donors. That is the common pattern at all American universities. Sure, you will get subjects that will be taught or areas considered that might not otherwise have been sufficiently funded, but I really don't think that it is corrupting in that sense. The British situation, I think, is a tad more complicated, partly because the academics in Great Britain are rather farther to the left than American ones are. The Arab money has also been used to sponsor numerous student groups and individual students at institutions which can now charge tuition who were not able to charge such fees in the past. But once again, I really don't think the piper is calling the tune, either in Great Britain or the United States.
All right. Again, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm interested in going back a little bit to what you were discussing before about the about social relationships, about the fact that people are constantly negotiating things, and perhaps the expectation that that people are always going to be arguing about things. If that is the case, and if, as you suggest, that one of the worst things that you could do is to say to somebody else simply, I'm not going to talk to you, to just turn you back and walk the other way. How then, if you have a government and it has policies and it has objectives and you have other parties that you're at fundamentally at odds with, how then do you, and if you would say, well, then maybe your worst strategy is to say to these people, we're just not going to talk to you, full stop. How then, though, if you feel that your agenda is fundamentally at odds with another party's agenda, well, how do you engage them? What is the possibility there for dialogue if you feel that you're so far apart yes. that your initial impulse is to say, well, obviously we have nothing to talk about?
I think from our perspective, it always looks as though the governments in the Middle East are all controlling of their own societies, oppressive, resistant to alternatives, that power is right at the top and right at the center, and everybody else is under the thumb of that. That really is not the feel in most of these countries. Now, I haven't worked in some of the places where I suspect it does feel more to be true. Syria may be an example. But in much of the rest of the Arab world, that is not the feel. Several things are important here. One is that the modern nation state, not just through communications and their armies, can indeed control a great deal about their own populations. But there's a flip side to it, and that is the government does not supply, as in this country and most Western countries, a real safety net for people. That means they have to find their own ways of securing themselves in a very uncertain environment. They can't depend on the central government. That is, by the way, a big opening for many of the fundamentalist groups. If there is an earthquake or a fire or a natural disaster or a flood or something, the government shows up the following week, but the Muslim Brothers, the fundamentalists, show up the next day. They are very often running the hospitals, the charitable institutions, not the central government. So you have a situation in which from our perspective, it looks like total centralized power, as if it was like the old Stalinist regime, which on the ground in the Arab world generally is not the feeling, and that everything is spread out much more. There also are sort of ironic ways of addressing it. I remember one man saying to me one day, you know, bribery is our form of democracy. And I said, really? How does that one work? And he said, look, if the big man says do such and such, but I bribe the guy under him not to do such and such, have I not put a limitation on his power? And is the limitation of power not the essence of democracy? Now, he was being ironic, I'm sure. But at the same time, in a system where you're constantly negotiating from very different bases, maybe from kinship, maybe from capturing the terms of discussion, that's why poets are so important in this part of the world, maybe the way in which you've done somebody a favor and you call it up in another way later on, you skirt around central power in all sorts of ways. Corruption, ironically, is a kind of devolution of power in an odd sort of way, and corruption can be a way in which you avoid the oppressiveness of the central regime. So we have to look both at the positive and, yes, negative aspects of the ways in which people forge these bonds of indebtedness with one another. But it is not all a simple matter in any of these countries, I don't think, of simple government oppressiveness.
Yeah. Just to give you a chance to talk a little bit more about another one of the questions that the caller raised that has to do with democracy, because we often do ask this question. There are terms where we at least think we know what we mean when we talk about things like democracy and liberty and rule of law and human rights, and we ask this question, is it possible in an Islamic society to have these things? As, and of course our point of reference is, well, the way that we think of them. We seem to think that those things are important, and we would like to see them in the way that we like to think they're important. And so people ask the question, well, is such a thing possible?
But it's not only possible. And again, I'm really not romanticizing. Mm-hmm. It exists in fact. If you look only at the kinds of issues we have a tendency to look at, political disputation at a public level, it's one thing. But if you look at humor, if you look at the comic strips in the Arab world, if you look at the jokes told about President Mubarak, there's a rich, vibrant tradition of political humor. Sure, there are bounds you don't go beyond. You don't criticize the king directly. You don't criticize the president directly. Part of that is deference. Part of it is respect. But there are also the other ways in which you show the humor and cut the person down to size in this kind of ethos, egalitarianizing sort of way. The same is true at very local levels, where, again, people may have multiple bases of power, and people rise and fall quite rapidly. And if there's anything Arabs love, it's keeping the game open. And if there's anything they hate, it's when they feel that this capacity to move to effect in the world is being restricted, either by now needing money to get into the game or physically restricted by inability to move around. That is very crucial to Arabs, to be able to rise and fall, to move within the rules of the game. And one sees this in the way in which marital alliances are negotiated, the way in which political favors at a very low level are done by people. I don't think we're just talking about democracy at the level of parliaments and presidents. We're talking also about people's sense of justice, the crucial word for Arabs, their sense of being able to move freely to effect in the world, as I suggest. And those are the things that, when they are restricted by powers, make them feel extremely uncomfortable indeed.
We're a little bit past our midpoint. I'd like to introduce again our guest, Lawrence Rosen. He's professor of anthropology at Princeton University, adjunct professor of law at Columbia Law School. He works mostly in the Muslim world. He's written a lot on Islamic law and the structure of social life in Islamic societies. He's the author of a book that will be published this summer that sets out some of these same sorts of ideas that's coming out from the University of Chicago Press, Varieties of Muslim Experience. He's here visiting the campus of the University of Illinois to give a talk in the MillerCom series, Protecting the Prophet, Understanding Muslim Reactions to the Danish Cartoon Controversy. And there also is a section in the book, Varieties of Muslim Experiences, is about that very thing. He'll be giving a talk this afternoon at 4 at the Levis Faculty Center on West Illinois in Urbana. And these programs are always open to the public and anybody free, and anybody who would like to attend is welcome. Also here on the program, questions are welcome too. 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. I think we have some other calls here. Back to a caller on our line number one. Hello?
Yes, that me?
Yes, go ahead.
Hey, great. Enjoying the show. Have a little bit of firsthand experience, but mostly through a brother who was a naval ROTC there in Illinois and a cousin who worked for a military aircraft manufacturer, to say that behind the scenes they see a lot of enjoyment of Western culture with the people that they worked for, and a camaraderie and a lot less resentment than you would see out front, and wondered if there wasn't something that was brewing underneath over there that isn't public. So appreciate your comments.
All right.
That's a really interesting notion, because for an anthropologist at least, the trick is, what is the meaning of something that we think we understand, that others understand the same way we do, but they may not? Take, for example, blue jeans. Blue jeans in China, or blue jeans in the old Soviet Union, were a way of demonstrating antipathy to the central state. Well, my students wear ripped blue jeans when, believe me, they can afford brand new ones. Are they showing a kind of solidarity with the poor? Are they trying to pretend to be something they aren't? One has to understand the meaning of a cultural item in different contexts. So here's the question I would at least raise. I think it's a wonderful notion when you say that your brother serving in the ROTC over there sees a lot of use of Western sort of items. But is the meaning the same? Let me just tell you a very quick story that may give you an example of this. Some time ago, I was in a town in North Africa, and a couple of young men came to me and they said, there's going to be this great American movie in town. and I wonder if you would come, and if there's anything we don't understand, you could explain it to us. I said, what's the movie? They said, it's called West Side Story. I said, okay, let's see. You remember the story. One gang comes up, confronts the other gang, and the guys are saying, yeah. And then one of them pulls a knife, and the guy starts saying, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then the other guy pulls a knife, and they say, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then one of them starts singing. And the guys turn to me, and they said, what kind of men do you have in America? What's with the singing? And it was almost impossible to explain to them the sort of musical genre that this was in. What they said was, look, a movie is like life. It's real. If your people do this thing, then it's true. But if they don't, because it is so real, it's lying. Now, they take to movies very quickly, but other kinds of things, like musical comedy, no, because it doesn't seem true and real to them. Cell phones, you use them for connecting with other people, even when you can use a picture of the other person, even though the Saudis don't like boys and girls looking at pictures of one another. But there are other things they don't take to. Portraiture. Portraits don't really tell them. We think when we look at a portrait, we get something about a person's character, personality, maybe even a degree of predictability of how they did or would behave. That's not how they read it. They don't see any of that information there, not because they're stupid, but because life is about forging alliances with other people. Now I can see that in a film. They take to soap operas like fish to water. Well, Meredith said last century that comedy is woman's great friend. Because if you set something in the household, you see these women maneuvering, often getting the guys to do things in spite of themselves. But the beauty of comedy as a genre is that it always reaffirms the social conventions at the end. So the not musical comedy, because it seems unreal, the meaning of it would not apply, so to speak, but the soap opera has immediate sort of delight and reality for them because they know that the women maneuver a great deal and have a good deal of power within the families and within the household. So one would want to look at which of the kinds of Western artifacts are being adopted, what meaning is being brought into them, and most particularly for an anthropologist, how that in turn connects to religion and politics and so many other domains so that people have a sense of the orderliness of their lives. What you accept and reject is very crucial. May I give you just one other example? The comparisons are always useful here. If you go out to Amish country in Pennsylvania, you'll see among some of the communities that they don't accept any kind of modern devices, but some of the others accept some but not other things. You'll see, for example, that in some of the communities, they will accept a tractor but not a baler. And you say to them, why the one but not the other? And the answer is, you don't really have a relationship with an animal like you do with a human being, so I might just as well have a tractor pulling this thing. But the baler would get between me and a fellow worker. If I've got one guy on the bed of the truck and I've got another guy pitching stuff up, we have to coordinate. We talk. We interact with one another. We accept the things that do not interfere with human relationships. We reject the ones that don't. Now, the same kind of thing can happen in any culture, happens in the Arab world, and I would love for you to try to find out from your brother which things they're and how they explain to him and to others why this but not that.
Yeah. Well, that and it raises in my mind this question. You know, we talk so much about antipathy between the Muslim world and the West. But I think that then you have to ask, well, what exactly does that mean? Does this mean that Arabs don't like Americans as individuals? Is there a problem with the American government? If we say they have a problem with Western values, then you'd have to say, well, okay, what does that mean exactly? Does that mean all of Western values? Does that mean some of Western values? It seems to be a much more complicated thing than often we make it out to be.
Let me perhaps respond with, a couple of concrete examples. At the time when the Khomeini regime took power in Iran, you always heard them talking about American oppression and pornography. And you'd say, what the heck do those two things have to do with one another? From their perspective, the Quran says, God endowed human beings with reason to overcome their passions, to better themselves and their dependence in the world, And the second most frequently used word in the Quran after the name of God himself is the word for knowledge, which they have enormous respect for. You have to place yourself with good teachers in contexts and relationship where you will develop your reasoning powers. But they saw in America a society, but more particularly a polity, in which we were giving in to our passions. Our passion for dominating other people unlike ourselves and pornography. To them, they were of a piece. They were both exemplifications of licentiousness, of not being in accord with God's instruction that one try to better one's reasoning powers over one's passions. Now, that's just an example of how something might be perceived, putting things together in a way in which we might not see, but which we at least have to understand, even if we disagree with. Similarly, you get situations in which people make a very strong distinction between the American government and the American people. One of the problems from the perspective of many Arabs these days, of course, is that the American government is not engaging them. Individual Americans who come to the countries, they're engaging with them. You can see the person face to face. You can interact with them. That's very crucial from an Arab's point of view to be able to assess another person. Incidentally, they tried a jury system in Morocco for a short time. It's a complete failure. Why? Well, the few people that I've talked to said, look, I just sort of sat there like a bump. I couldn't engage the person. I couldn't interact with him. How can I possibly tell a person is telling me the truth if I can't interact with him? This constant negotiating of interactive relationships was not part of the system of a jury system. They really had to abandon it. Or when I say to people that we don't want to hear evidence of your character or your past deeds in most criminal proceedings, they say, how in the world can you then judge a person? Don't you need to know what they've done, who they're connected to, what they've done in many instances? So again, it's how the pieces are put together a little differently than we do, maybe just 5 degrees off, but it's far enough away to make a significant difference. And for things that may not seem to us to be connected to seem to them, and vice versa, to be connected. It's one of the reasons why I think we, you know, understanding people's categories and how they put those categories together, you can ultimately disagree profoundly about it. But understanding that is crucial, and engagement is absolutely central from any Muslim's perspective. You can't turn away from them and expect not to be engaging them so that that give and take takes place, however it may result.
Yeah. We have some other callers here. Let's continue. We'll talk with someone next in Champaign, and this is line number 2. Hello.
Yeah, I hear a small comment, and that is, we should not identify Islam or the practices or the teaching of Islam with the current prevailing conditions and rulers. Saudi kings or Jordanian king or Moroccan, they are not representing Islam or the Islamic democracy. This is one of my comments. You know, people should read or look at the lives of the caliphs, the first four, and see how were things at that time. When at the time the Western countries were in darkness, Islam gave women equal rights. They were allowed to vote. They were allowed to criticize even the caliph. The caliph was their servant, not the ruler. So I think people are ignorant when they just say, hey, Islam is not democracy, is against democracy. We have a different values of democracy. See, a few hundred Congress members can tell, you know, how to behave, the president, how to behave, go to war, not go to war. In Islam, even a single person can stand up and tell this is wrong.
You're certainly
the ruler, and the ruler has to answer him. It is not, the ruler is not responsible to only a few hundred people.
May I respond to that for a moment? I think you're absolutely right that for many people in the Arab world and other parts of the Muslim world, equating Islamic leadership with present position as ruler are not identical. Many people regard their leaders as legitimate in the sense of how they came to be in that position, but by no means necessarily legitimized as Islamic or religious leaders. There are exceptions. The idea that the king of Morocco is a descendant of the prophet in a line of the prophet and that the dynasty has been there since the 16th century is a not insignificant part of his legitimacy in the eyes of the people, even if they do not feel that at all times each king has been an ideal Muslim. Similarly, the restrictions, as you say, of approval, so to speak, of the Islamic ideal of a leader may fall far short of what is expected. Yes, there are those who would like to take things back to the days of the early caliphs. With all due respect, four of them were murdered by their opponents, so I'm not sure that one can go back to the caliphate as an ideal moment in Arab history. And when one
Ibrahim Lincoln was also murdered.
Yes, yes, I understand. What I'm just trying to suggest...
Should you say democracy is not working?
Oh, no, you're quite right. I'm not trying to say that democracy is antithetical to Islam, quite the contrary, nor am I suggesting that every Muslim leader is regarded as religiously legitimate in the eyes of all of his people. What I am suggesting is that aspects of this are aspects of any person. My understanding of Islam is that one must incorporate these attitudes, beliefs, and intentions within oneself. And if a leader does not do that, the leader lacks that kind of Muslim leadership that may be vital. At the same time, there is a kind of distinction made between religious leadership and a kind of secular leadership, and that shows up in a variety of ways in Islamic history. So it's a complex issue, one I'm sure you understand far better than I, but one that one can neither idealize in all honesty, nor demonize, certainly. Finally, just a quick remark about women, equal rights, and the individual standing up to power. That latter is really very important, and on many occasions I have seen men stand up to power in ways that are, you know, really would lift the heart of an Abraham Lincoln. I've seen people have to engage in situations of minor corruption, knowing and feeling how corrupting it was for them as Muslims and standing up against it quite heroically at times. So the values are there. The institutions need building and rebuilding, perhaps, and the sense of individual worth that may be undermined by corrupt leaders is really the single most deleterious feature of the polity of some of these countries.
Yeah. I want to thank the caller and hope you will forgive me for jumping in here. We just have about 5 minutes left and I have several callers and I'd like to try to include at least one or two more. Our guest, by the way, is Lawrence Rosen. He's professor of anthropology at Princeton University. Next, we'll talk with someone in Urbana, and that would be line number three. Hello?
Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, I feel one huge source of power in American politics and society is the corporation, and I feel it has a degrading effect on our system of democracy. I was wondering if you could comment on the influence of the corporation in the Muslim society, both from internal corporations and also from Western transnational corporations. And I'll get off and listen on the radio. Thanks.
All right.
Wow, that's a difficult question for me. I know very little about corporate structures within the Muslim world, especially the Arab world. I can tell you one anecdote. At one point in Morocco, I noticed that where usually shopkeepers kept pictures of the king in their shops, there were no pictures around. And it was a time when there was a lot of popular sentiment against some of his particular policies. When I asked a very knowledgeable gentleman, "Where are the pictures of the king?" he said, "Now you will see them hanging in the various corporate headquarters." Clearly, there are alliances between those in power and those with money, and that may very well involve local corporations as well as foreign ones. But the truth of the matter is, I do not know enough about the structure of corporations operating within these Arab countries to really be able to respond to your quite wonderful question.
All right. Next, someone in Effingham. This is line four. Hello.
Yes, a little history. Mesopotamia being the seat of civilization, and it were they polytheistic, and then the idea of one God, I think, came along a couple thousand years later, and do Christians and Muslims worship the same God?
Certainly from the Muslims' perspective, they do. Remember that from the Muslim perspective, the Quran is the completion, not the elimination, of that which went before. Islam recognizes Jesus, Moses, Abraham, many other prophets, thousands of prophets who preceded Muhammad, who's regarded as the last in the line of the prophets. And the notion of the people of the book, Jews, Christians in particular, as being favored peoples, is very significant in Islam. So one ought not to think of these as different gods, but as different versions, if you wish, of and approaches toward what's regarded as the same God.
Does that get at your question, Carl?
Yes, sir. Thank you very much. David.
Well, then we'll go to somebody on a cell phone here. Line number one. Hello.
Yes, a question on Sharia law. The networks you've described, how informed are these social networks by Sharia? And part two, what do you think of Rowan Williams' thoughts about trying to incorporate Sharia law into British society? I'll take my call off the air. Thanks.
All right. Let me take the second point first. As you probably know, the Archbishop of Canterbury recently suggested that different religious laws ought to govern at least some aspects of people's lives in Great Britain. I've read the complete text. I think he's a little bit misunderstood, but he contributed to the misunderstanding by lack of clarity. There certainly are other countries, other times, when we have allowed, say, family law to be governed by religious law. I don't think that's about to happen in Great Britain. It's certainly not going to happen in this country, though you can have versions of it. Remember that we have several states, Louisiana, possibly Arkansas, don't quote me on that one, that now allow what are called covenant marriages, which means you can agree to dispense with certain legal rights to divorce that would otherwise be granted to you by the state. So you can make additions to it in the light of your own religion. There's a very crucial thing to keep in mind about the first point you raise. In virtually every Muslim country I know, and at every period of time, there is some version of a saying that custom takes precedence even over the Sharia, the sacred law. That may sound very odd indeed, but it is very true. And you see that local practice, which facilitates those interrelationships, is what is very crucial. And as people will constantly say, if it has that kind of consequence to enable relationships, it is in fulfillment of the general theme of the religious law, but the specifics of local custom can take precedence even over a provision in the sacred law. And a good example of that is that Islamic law is pretty clear about who gets custody of children when, but you go into the courts, even of Iran, post-revolutionary Iran, and what you see is that very often custody is given to women because they have a job, because they are better educated than the men, even though the Sharia may suggest to the contrary, because of a desirable social consequence. By the way, for whatever stereotype you may have of the Muslim world, the few studies done in the courts show that roughly 90% of the time, women actually win their cases in the Sharia courts. We can talk more about that some other time, but it should at least disrupt any stereotypes.
We have just about 2 minutes left. Let me ask you a practical sort of question. I'm going to make myself the President of the United States, and then I'm going to ask you to be my Secretary of State for the Middle East and be my advisor on policy towards the Arab world. And I'm going to say, obviously, I think that it's very important for the United States to improve its relations with the Arab Muslim world. What should I do?
Engage them. It's a process. It's not a point. It's an ongoing relationship. It is not a static situation. When, with all due respect, President Bush came to office pre-9/11 and basically refused to engage the Arabs, leaving matters, not wanting to engage them in quite the same way that Clinton had, many Arabs did indeed feel that it was not only disrespect, but how in the world am I supposed to negotiate, deal in any way with somebody who simply will not engage us in conversation? We're having that concern right now. Should the U.S. engage Hamas or Hezbollah for that matter? Carter's recent visit is saying you have got to talk to these folks. The present administration is saying, no, you don't. My only recommendation would be you've got to engage people. That's crucial. It is a process. It is not predetermined what the result will be. But if you don't engage people, the results cannot possibly be beneficial.
Well, there we will leave it with the suggestion that if you're interested in more of the thoughts of our guest, Lawrence Rosen, you can look for his forthcoming book, published to be published this summer, exploring many of these same issues, varieties of Muslim experience, encounters with encounters with Arab political and cultural life, be published by the University of Chicago Press in July. Is that what you're thinking?
Actually,
about?
Next May. May, this coming month.
This coming, no, oh, good, very month. Good. Soon. You can find this soon in a bookstore near you. And, of course, if you're in and around Champaign-Urbana, you'd like to hear more from him. He'll be talking on the topic, Protecting the Prophet, Understanding Muslim Reactions to the Danish Cartoon Controversy. That's today at 4 o'clock at the Levis Faculty Center on the campus on West Illinois. It's an event in the MillerCom series. Anyone who is interested in attending should feel welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you.